FM 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for joining us. Today on the show, disgraced movie producer Harvey Weinstein has been sentenced to 23 years in prison for sexual assault. We'll tell you what that could mean for a trial expected to take place right here in Los Angeles. Plus, we bring you the latest on a KPCC investigative series about illegal boarding houses in the San Gabriel Valley, barely habitable apartments and homes where newly arrived Chinese immigrants are forced to live because they can't afford any place else to go.
So the landlords take advantage of this daunting situation.
That's coming up. But first, the COVID-19 virus and how it's impacting our community. Earlier today, Los Angeles County health officials reported the first local death due to COVID-19, a woman in her 60s who was not a resident but visiting her friends here. She also had traveled extensively. But the main message from local health officials right now is simply do not panic. There are few cases here locally. Still, though, officials are taking precautions. In just the last 24 hours, several events have been canceled due to concerns, and many college classes have moved online. Also, the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, or LASA, said Tuesday it will provide more resources to homeless people in hopes of preventing the spread of the virus that causes COVID-19. And that includes improved communication and additional sanitation equipment. Officials did not provide further details, but to give us an on-the-ground look on what is happening with the homeless populations, we have the Reverend Andy Bales, CEO of Union Rescue Mission in downtown Los Angeles. Reverend, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you, A.
Now, I know that you are joining us now from a plane in D.C., so thank you very much for taking a little extra time. You're meeting with officials at the Housing and Urban Development in D.C. How vulnerable right now might L.A.'s homeless population be if the virus spreads through shelters and the streets?
I think the folks on the streets are, of course, more vulnerable. They won't have the care that they need. They won't have the hygiene stations that they need. They won't have the restrooms or showers facilities. They're certainly at risk, and a lot of the folks who are in our rescue mission and in shelters have a lot of health issues. They certainly are at risk. I did want to say that if you are thinking about going out and volunteering with people in an encampment or people at a rescue mission, you might think twice if you've traveled in a country that's been impacted or if you've been around folks or if you have a fever and a cough. It would be best not to bring this coronavirus or other virus to the people in the shelters and on the streets.
So as much as you'd like to help, just stay away for now. Can you tell us some of the measures you've installed in your building to prepare and protect people?
We were fortunate enough to have the L.A. County Department of Health Services move into our clinic space about 2 weeks ago. UCLA moved out in December, and a lot of people would say we were fortunate. We'd say we were blessed that the L.A. County Department of Health Service doctors and nurses moved in. They coached us. They told us to get ready. They told us to create lots of cleaning stations. We have a wash station out front in our front entrance, two in our back entrance. We have sanitizers throughout. We've prepared a quarantine room in our gym for single men and women. We've prepared a quarantine area for families on our fifth floor wing. We bought personal protective gear to deliver food to anybody that goes to quarantine, to clean up after anybody that goes to quarantine. We're washing all the door handles and elevator knobs, and we're doing a bunch.
And are you telling your staff, just like other places, to not come to work if they are sick, if they are feeling sick?
Absolutely. Okay. If they have a fever and a cough, please stay home. If they're sick in any way, really, please stay home. If you can, work from home. Frontline staff, of course, can't work from home. They'll be working with our guests, and we're just getting prepared for a different way of life for a while and hoping that we receive some help. We purchased a lot of personal protective gear, masks, and biohazard bags and things to get ready. We purchased those three standalone cleaning stations, but we did all that on our own dime. We're hoping that some aid comes in, perhaps. The county could offer to come in and clean. Experts could come in and clean up after our restrooms and facilities that are in quarantine area.
Reverend, about that help that you're hoping the county can come through on. Are you good with what the county has been able to do for the homeless population so far?
Well, the city has talked about taking hygiene stations and restrooms out to the encampments. I'd like to reiterate again, if we could get everybody under a triage roof of some kind that has wash stations, restrooms, that would be the best thing we could do. Minimum, we should offer hygiene stations and restrooms and showers. But the best thing we could do is bring people under a roof, especially if they're sick. We've posted posters throughout our building. If you have a fever or a cough, tell someone. Don't hide. Tell someone. We've posted pictures outside that say, if you have a fever or a cough, come in. Don't suffer out on the streets alone.
Talking to the Reverend Andy Bales, CEO of Union Rescue Mission in downtown Los Angeles. He is kind enough to join us on a plane right now. L.A. City Council, Reverend, has been on recess, returns tomorrow. LASA issued a statement about what it's doing, but in a request, interview request to KBCC, it deferred to the Department of Public Health for further questions. Wondering what your assessment has been on the speed and seriousness of local leaders in addressing this situation.
Well, I would say it's never fast enough, right? The hygiene, I don't know, but I don't think the hygiene stations are out yet. I don't think showers are out yet. I don't think restrooms are out yet at the encampments. But I would only be satisfied if the triage centers were already set up and they were ready to receive anybody who has these symptoms from the streets.
So never fast enough, but is it good? Is it good enough so far?
No, I don't think it's good enough so far. I think we're a little behind. We've had people already show signs of flu, but we can't confirm whether it's flu or coronavirus because there's not enough testing kits.
What have you been told about the testing kits? Are any on the way?
We're still waiting. I don't know, but we've had some people go to the hospital with the flu, come back, and not get a test yet. There may be other reasons for that, but we were told by a doctor to just really get ready on our own because people who are devastated by homelessness might be last on the list, but Barbara Ferrer, I got some comfort from her yesterday. The L.A. County Department of Health, she said we are going to make people who are homeless a priority, and I hope they live up to that.
That's the Reverend Andy Bales, CEO of Union Rescue Mission in downtown Los Angeles, kind enough to join us from a plane. Reverend, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, A. God bless you, man.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. As some districts in the state move to close schools due to coronavirus concerns, all eyes here are on LAUSD. Last night, the Los Angeles Unified School District Board voted to declare an emergency and gave Superintendent Austin Buettner the broad authority to, quote, take any and all actions necessary to keep the system running. LAUSD is the second largest school district in the nation. KPCC's education reporter Carla Javier is here to tell us what's going on. Carla, welcome back.
Thanks so much, A.
All right, now, first off, can you tell us more about this emergency declaration and authorization for Austin
Buettner? Yeah. So yesterday, the board called this special meeting to address this issue, coronavirus, COVID-19. Here's how Superintendent Austin Buettner described what the district needs.
Our usual manner of procurement, our usual manner of deliberation, while appropriate in much circumstance, will not allow us to make sure we have paper towels and soap in all of our schools tomorrow. We have to do things differently and recognize that time is not something we can control.
And that's what the special board meeting and the emergency declaration and the authorization and resolution, that's what all of that was about. It wasn't about closing schools yet. It wasn't intended to cause any panic. But if needed, it would allow Buettner to do things like make contracts without the normal bureaucratic bureaucratic bid process, no matter the cost. Other things mentioned were allowing Buettner to move students and staff around, to get equipment for virtual learning, and to hire more nurses, things like that.
So it sounds like just be ready for anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what did the board members have to say about it?
Well, all the board members recognized the need, but some also acknowledged the huge amount of power that the board was handing to Buettner. Here's how board member Jackie Goldberg summed it up during discussion.
And I just hope that we can continue to have very quick response to the board as to what you're doing and when you're doing it and why you're doing it.
And ultimately, the board did vote unanimously to declare the emergency conditions and to hand broad authority over to Buettner, while also promising to keep a close eye on him through the process.
All right, so what is the district's current plan to keep schools safe and operational?
Well, Deputy Superintendent Megan Riley, who's been put in charge of this coronavirus effort, gave an update during the regular school board meeting. Here's what she said about cleaning the schools themselves.
We've done heroic efforts of increased frequency in cleaning the high-use areas, bathrooms, lunch areas, even the faculty lounge coffee pot, and drinking fountains, doorknobs, playgrounds, locker rooms, and our school buses, and regularly cleaning in high common areas.
And she also reminded folks to wash their hands thoroughly and often.
And that's good advice generally, not just necessarily with what's going on right now.
Sure.
And what are some examples the district is thinking about doing in case the situation maybe changes and schools have to close, like remote learning, for example?
Yeah, that came up at the meeting. Riley really emphasized the commitment to educating kids, even if school sites close.
The most important thing that we can do is keep the continuity and kids in school, and then if they can't be in school, then education still continues.
She said the district has some tools for online instruction and learning through the district's TV channel, KLCS. But in discussion, Riley recognized that not all LAUSD families have access to devices or internet at home. Superintendent Buettner has actually emailed internet companies and providers looking to them for help with this. He also asked state health and education officials, as well as state legislators, for about $50 million to provide devices to kids who don't have them. In that letter, he estimated that the district would need about 150,000 of those devices to be able to serve all students K through 12.
150,000 is a lot of devices.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. On that note, actually, a lot of kids at LAUSD rely on school meals, breakfast, lunches, even dinners in some locations. Any plan in place yet to on how to maintain that service even if schools are closed?
Yeah. Riley said that the district produces over 700,000 meals a day. And if there were extended closures, that the district is looking into what she called shelf meals. She said those are more resilient and that the district already has an inventory of those. And later, Buettner said that if some campuses were to close, the district would try to distribute those meals at the campuses that were available. He said the district would work with county and public safety authorities to make sure that those meals are distributed safely.
What state help is the district looking for?
So in that letter, Superintendent Austin Buettner sent to state officials, he asked for that $50 million I mentioned to help with online learning. He also asked for things like relief from attendance-based funding rules, especially since the district is encouraging students and staff who don't feel so good to stay at home, and also support for the over 77,000 staff that the district does employ, making sure that they're supported even if schools do have to close.
That's KPCC's Carla Javier. She has more about what LAUSD is doing on our website, LAIST.com. That's LAIST.com. Carla, thanks a lot, and don't go too far. We're going to talk in a bit.
Thanks, A.
All right, moving on. Throughout the San Gabriel Valley, thousands of people live in illegal boarding houses. These are barely habitable, sometimes dangerous apartment units and homes crammed full of beds. They cater to newly arrived Chinese immigrants with little money and few skills. KPCC's Yinji Wang has been reporting on these boarding houses for almost the past year, and she joins us now. Hello, Yinji.
Hello, A.
You've been researching these boarding houses. You visited places that are overcrowded, illegal, sometimes dangerous. Thousands of Chinese immigrants are enduring these conditions in the San Gabriel Valley. How did you come across this story?
Well, I came to USC to study journalism last year. I was doing some reporting on working conditions of new Chinese immigrants and started to hear about these boarding houses or places that are known in Chinese as family motels.
Family motels. And what are these family motels or boarding houses? How do they work?
Often they are one or two bedroom apartment units, which can have a dozen beds or mattresses. People rent by the day or by the week for about $10 to $20 a night. And they pay rent to the person whose name is on the lease. This person is known as secondhand landlord.
Secondhand landlord. All right, so secondhand landlords are charging just 10 bucks a night. That's incredible. That's nothing. But a dozen people in a two bedroom apartment also can't be safe or legal, right?
No, it's not safe and it's not legal either. The concern here is that these places are so packed, it can be difficult to get out in an emergency, like a fire or an earthquake. Here is Monterey Park's former fire chief, Scott Haberly, describing the hazards.
That's one danger because you have more people in the room than supposed to, so they have limited exit ability to get out.
Yeah, that makes sense. Fire and earthquake danger. So how widespread is the problem? And do we know how many of these boarding houses might exist?
Well, we don't have the full picture. I analyzed the records for boarding house cases in four San Gabriel Valley cities, Monterey Park, San Gabriel, Alhambra, and Rosemead. All have high numbers of Chinese immigrants living at the bottom rung of the housing market. And together, those cities have opened at least 650 cases as a result of complaints about the boarding houses since 2013. But many officials and experts believe the number of unreported units is far higher.
Why do they think the number might be higher?
For one, the tenants don't complain because they have no other place to go. I spoke to UCLA Asian American Studies Professor Min Zhou.
They cannot afford to live in decent housing. And then they are not even eligible for government subsidized housing, right? Because they don't have legal status. So the landlords kind of take advantage of this daunting situation of the undocumented immigrants.
So these people really don't have many options. Does that make enforcement complicated?
That's correct. Here is Monterey Park council member Peter Chen. He says they have to make judgment calls about when to crack down. They don't want to force people onto the streets.
So if people have like 7 or 8 under 10 people, I mean, it's not legal, but it's acceptable to me personally. So if no one report them, we let it go.
So there is no easy solution here. But we do know there are likely thousands, maybe more people living in these boarding houses. And officials feel like their hands are tied.
That's KPCC's Yinji Wang. And we'll have more on this story on LAIST.com. That's LAIST.com. Yinji, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Lots of news happening in the showbiz world, so let's get right to it. Let's go on the lot.
Hey, shut up! God, I wish you'd
stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan back from vacation, feeling refreshed, and hopefully so, because we got a lot of news to talk about. Harvey Weinstein sentenced to 23 years in prison, and the industry at large being hit hard as more cases of COVID-19 virus pop up around the world. Rebecca, welcome back.
Hi.
All right, big news today. Harvey Weinstein sentenced to 23 years in prison for sexually assaulting two women. Rebecca, why is this a landmark sentencing?
Well, of course, Weinstein is the central figure in the Me Too movement. And the revelations about his predatory behavior toward women helped spark this entire wave of secret sharing. But despite that, a lot of people, including me, including his victims, were skeptical he would ever actually face any jail time.
Really?
Because of how hard it is to mount a successful sexual assault case, any sexual assault case, never mind one against someone with so much wealth and so much power. The cases in New York didn't seem to be particularly strong. So the fact that he is not only found guilty, but facing 23 years in prison signals that there's not just been a massive cultural shift due to Me Too, but there's also been a shift in the justice system.
The victims of Harvey Weinstein, Rebecca, wondering, has there been any response from them so far?
Well, eight of them were at a conference in L.A. today, shortly after the sentencing was announced, and they expressed, I guess what you'd call happy shock that he was facing that long of a sentence. As victim Catherine Kendall put it, quote, we were seen. Weinstein had been found guilty of sexual assault, but the jury acquitted him of the most serious charge, which was predatory sexual assault. So there were some fears among his victims that he would get a lenient sentence.
Well, speaking of that, Weinstein's lawyers tried for the minimum sentence of 5 years. They'd argued that he'd been through enough ridicule and suffering. They also cited his health as a factor. What do we know on that front?
Well, after he was found guilty, Weinstein was hospitalized for heart palpitations. He ended up having a stent inserted. He's 67 years old. He's also had back problems. He's clearly not in good health. And a sentence of 23 years, if fully served, would put him at 90 years old.
Wow. All right. But that's New York. It's not over yet because Weinstein still has an L.A. trial to contend with. So remind our listeners, what are the details of this trial and what charges is he facing?
In L.A., Weinstein is charged with raping one woman and sexually assaulting another in separate incidents over a two-day period in 2013. He's going to be arraigned on those charges in the coming week. So that trial is, you know, set to follow.
Will what happened in New York have any bearing, you think, on what might happen in this L.A. trial?
Well, it'll be interesting to see how things unfold in the coming weeks. Weinstein's attorneys have said that they plan to appeal the New York verdict, which would happen in July. So he's going to be doing, in the next few months, a lot of traveling back and forth for his arraignment in L.A., for his appeal in New York, and ultimately wherever he ends up imprisoned.
All right. So now let's move on to COVID-19. Rebecca, I alluded to this earlier. Last 48 hours alone, there's been a ton of movement due to concerns over the virus. A lot of big events have been canceled. South by Southwest was the first. Catch us up on some of the others, though.
Right. So Coachella and Stagecoach have been postponed until the fall. NAB, which is a technology conference that was supposed to happen in Las Vegas in April, was just canceled today. And then there are a lot of other events that we're sort of waiting but expecting will be canceled, things like the Cannes Film Festival, which is planned for May.
And I just saw the NCAA men's and women's college basketball tournament will be played without fans. That just came down not too long ago. Wondering, when it comes to South by Southwest, how has that cancellation affected the whole process of getting films out? Because typically an event like this serves as a showcase for indie films. How will they be now sold to distributors?
Right. So normally what happens at South by Southwest is these independent films screen for audiences and critics, and distributors attend those screenings, see how they play, what had the room, you know, laughing or smiling
Crowd,
or whatever. Yeah, and read the crowd. South by is especially known for being a good launch pad for comedies and genre films. So now filmmakers are scrambling to set up private screenings for potential buyers, but inevitably, some of that impact, potential impact, is going to be muted if a buyer is sitting in a room alone watching a comedy.
And we know Hollywood, Rebecca, they don't like to take chances. If they can't get a feel for how this movie might play out, they might not take a chance and invest in the movie.
Right. I mean, it's a risk-averse industry to begin with, so this really makes a difficult task even harder.
And there have been some other preventive measures taken. Another major movie's release date has been pushed, for example. Tell us about that one.
Right. Well, the James Bond movie has been pushed. Peter Rabbit 2 has been pushed. Both these movies were supposed to open this spring and are not going to anymore. Also, you know, the Screen Actors Guild and the Writers Guild have canceled their in-person meetings. There's a lot of sort of fluidity in how the industry is handling things. It's sort of changing by the hour. One of the big issues that people are watching right now is whether people will keep going to the movies. as of now, people can go to the movies. Will they choose to? We're getting into a time of year, particularly when we get into April and May, when studios are typically releasing their biggest, most expensive films. Disney's got Black Widow. Universal has Fast and Furious 9. These are movies that need to make $1 billion at the box office for them to be successful. If people are either afraid to go out or if local municipalities force the closure of theaters, it will be impossible for them to make back that kind of money.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big picture view of what this could mean for the industry, right? I mean, it's a lot of money is going to be lost. A lot of jobs are at stake.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable how many industries this is touching. And the entertainment industry, it's really everywhere from how people ought to behave on sets. For instance, I was on the set of a movie shooting on Friday where there were 300 extras that were singing and dancing and touching. And, you know, there is a bottle of hand sanitizer in the corner. But you know, when all these people then go to craft services and grab their lunch for the day, movie production environments, people are working long hours. They're often really tired. It is a sort of recipe for sharing any kind of bug.
Rebecca, you cover Hollywood. If Hollywood is on hold, what does this mean for your job?
Well, I mean, for me, a lot of what I do is attend events in order to sort of talk to people and get story ideas and build relationships, track down information. South by Southwest, I was supposed to be on the film jury. That's not happening, although we may be having our jury deliberations remotely. So we would screen the films on a link and then sort of meet as a jury, you know, perhaps via video conference or something. The logistics are still being worked out. So now, you know, I'm just going to be using the phone and email a lot more and a lot less in-person contact. But I rely on that a lot to sort of do my job. So it's an adjustment.
Yeah. So on that topic of one-on-one interviews for a reporter, Major League Baseball closed clubhouses to reporters. And I used to, you know, live in the clubhouse back in my old sports reporting days. So a lot of players, I know a lot of players are going to be thrilled that they won't have to deal
right.
with reporters. But Cincinnati Red star Joey Votto, he offered a different take. And he said a vast majority of stories involve nuance, emotion, personal relationships. A perception of how a person player reacted can be told through facial expressions, getting to know that person and tone. The media is the bridge that connects the athlete with the public. And without that close proximity, I don't personally think you can get that human component. So I'm wondering, Rebecca, you know, taking a cue from that sports angle, will nuance be missing in some stories for a while?
I mean, I think there's no question that actual face-to-face human connection is an important part in the way stories are told, whether it's about sports or entertainment or other topics. I mean, the truth is a lot of reporters are still going to be out there doing that despite the health risk because it's central to our jobs. So yes, coverage of a baseball game or a movie premiere might suffer, but the sort of larger storytelling that goes into journalism, there's no question people are going to be out there doing that.
We're still going to read your stuff, Rebecca, in the Hollywood Reporter, no matter what. I don't care what you put out there, I'm going to read it.
Good.
All right, now it's not just the big name festivals, films, and events that are getting canceled or postponed. Television's also making some changes as well. Can you tell us about the preventative measures that have been made on a television production level?
Right. Well, some shows depend on live studio audiences, shows like Jeopardy, Wheel of Fortune, all the major late night shows are all now going to be proceeding without their live studio audiences. This week, when The Bachelor taped its finale, members of the studio audience had to sign a waiver saying they hadn't traveled to one of the places where the pandemic has been in full effect, you know, China, Korea, Italy, Iran. So in some ways, TV is one business that stands to benefit from this. If everybody has to stay home, they'll have nothing else to do. But in terms of the way TV is produced and relies on the energy of a live audience, sometimes that's changing.
Fan reaction, right? That is part of the show. And that that mm-hmm. energy, as you mentioned, won't be there. And actually, this all comes around the same time a crew member for Fox's Next tested positive for coronavirus. Any idea what kind of protocol will be implemented moving forward as a result of that?
Right. Well, according to the Chicago Tribune, this was a woman in her 50s who had traveled from California to the Chicago set of the show. The show has already finished production, so it doesn't need to shut down. But the cast and crew members who worked on it have been notified, and whether they will need to quarantine is unclear. The issue of sets and production in general is still pretty fluid. Mission Impossible, which had been shooting in Italy near an area of enormous problem, had to shut down. how long they shut down, whether people who worked on that can take other jobs, whether tests are available to all these people. These are all questions that are unanswered at this point.
And Rebecca, you've talked about changes in your workflow. We've got changes here at KPCC as well. Yet theme parks like Disneyland remain open. What's the logic there, Rebecca? That's a lot of people all in a small space.
Right. Well, they say they're stepping up their cleaning procedures. They're making hand sanitizer readily available. The truth is there are some businesses like ours that can continue to operate with some staff working remotely or people limiting non-essential travel. But theme parks are either open or they're closed. Yeah. And for now, anyway, in the United States, they're open.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Holly Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk all things showbiz. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.